Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of the hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very excited today to be interviewing really the expert on all things railways in the UK, in Britain, Christian Wolmar, whose latest book is titled British Rail, A New History, out from Penguin in 2022. This is a really fascinating book, both because British Rail is a key part of really 20th and 21st century infrastructure in the UK in a lot of ways. And also because it's something that I think a lot of people, certainly myself included, thought we knew kind of all the main things about this institution that has now been privatized. And yet, turns out, with this expertise from Christian, there's a massive amount we don't necessarily know. So I'm really excited to welcome you, Christian, to the podcast to tell us about British Rail.
Thank you.
Could you please introduce yourself a bit and explain why, amongst all of your expertise, you decided to write this book?
Okay, well, I've written around 20 books. I'm essentially a journalist, and I suppose I still approach my books in a journalistic way, although I try to ensure they are reasonably rigorous. And so I've written histories of the London Underground, of Britain's railways, of the Trans-Siberian, of Indian railways, of indeed American railways, or railroads as we call them there. I thought there was actually a gap about a story of British Rail. I had written, as one of my first books, kind of 20 years ago, the story of privatization and why the railways were sold off. I thought there was a real gap that nobody had really explained the story of British Rail's 50-year history, you know, nationalised in 1948 and privatised almost exactly 50 years after that. And I thought it was an interesting subject, both as railway history and kind of setting that out, but also to look at a state enterprise and assess both its strengths and weaknesses.
That makes sense. We're obviously not going to be able to go into all of the detail and all of the really fascinating stories that you include in the book, but hopefully we can give listeners sort of a taste of some of the main points. And so the obvious place to start with is, why was British Railways created and what initial challenges did it face?
Well, it was created in 1948, post-war, really kind of two reasons. I mean, one was a political one, that the Labour Party had taken over and believed in state involvement, not least in various other industries, notably steel, electricity, and so on, were all kind of incorporated into the state. But the other reason was because the system had been enormously run down during the war. It had been used extremely heavily. Obviously, it had been bombed somewhat, although not very extensively, but nevertheless, there was still some damage. But most importantly, it had not been subject to much investment and maintenance because there were other priorities, notably the armaments industry. So it was in a parlous state. It was owned by four private companies, which had been created in 1923, and they would not have had the money to invest in improving it and bring it back up to pre-war standards. So it was a pretty obvious thing for the state to take over and both operate and manage.
How did it fare then initially? You detail quite a number of challenges at the beginning of its existence.
Yes, and to be honest, in the first few years, it didn't do particularly well. It was incorporated into a larger organization called the British Transport Commission, which not only had the railways, but had the waterways and even long distance road transport. And it was rather forgotten within that huge organization. And certainly its investment needs were, for the first 6 or 7 years, not at all addressed. And there was always this idea, and this is a recurring theme of the book, or indeed any history of the railways, that the railways should pay for themselves, that you know, they should make a profit, or at least not lose much money, and therefore should not be a burden on the state. And this was always a kind of imperative of government. And I think that meant that far from kind of investing in the railways, there was always the idea of, well, let's cut back. If we don't run this branch line, we'll save a bit of money, rather than looking at you know, this fantastic network inherited from the Victorians, and thinking, well, we could make this better. We could gather in kind of more passengers if we ran the trains a bit faster or changed over to diesel or electric locomotives and so on. So the first 7 or 8 years were characterized by really a lack of imagination from government. And then there was suddenly a U-turn. There was a strike, and they wanted to buy off the threat of the strike. They realized that the railways had been run down and had very little investment. And so they announced this big program, which was worth over £1 billion at the time, you know, which probably reflects about £22 billion now, a vast amount of money to improve the railways. So both in terms of bringing in new rolling stock, diesels in particular, replacing many of the steam engines, electrification of some of the network, and also some other ideas which were probably not so strong for candidates for investment, like, for example, creating huge marshalling yards. That's where wagons were kind of sorted out into trains, which in fact was a pretty redundant technology even by the 1950s. So there was some good spending, but some of that money was wasted.
Mm. I wanted to ask more about electrification, because as you just mentioned it there, and you show in the book that it wasn't exactly a sort of linear or straightforward process for British Rail to be electrified. So can you kind of tell us about how that happened?
Well, British Rail kept its steam locomotives for far too long, but there were reasons for that. There was not only the conservative nature of railway managers who, you know, liked these big, I mean, a lot of them were kind of train spotter types, really. They liked these big steam engines and, you know, smoke pouring up into the countryside and that wonderful noise they make. So they liked them. But also, you have to remember that there was a great shortage of steel, of other components to make electric locomotives. There was no, effectively, no industry that made them in the UK until the mid-50s, when they did start to develop an industry. So, and coal was plentiful. But electricity had to be generated by other ways, and certainly diesel was really not available in any quantity. So they kept their steam locomotives, and then suddenly they decided, look, this is crazy. We've got to move over to electric or diesel. And there is a problem with electrification, which is that there's a lot of sunk cost. You have to invest in the pylons, in the cables, in the power generation, and in the locomotives. And therefore, there was a reluctance to go down that path. And so initially, most of the changeover from steam was for diesels, as in the, by the mid-50s, it became easier to import some of the fuel necessary.
How then was electrification kind of finally accomplished?
Well, the first big electrification scheme was what we call the West Coast Main Line, which runs between London and Manchester, Liverpool, and Glasgow via Birmingham. And that was accomplished really in a rather strange way, that there was a decision to do it in the late 50s as part of the modernization plan. And British Rail kind of started doing it. But as I describe in the book, there was never quite the go-ahead to do it all. But kind of British Rail, in fact, did it almost by subterfuges, doing bits here and there, and then eventually joining it all up. And finally electrified the whole line by 63. And that was a fantastic success. So suddenly, rather than these nasty, dirty steam engines, even people who left their windows open on the trains, there was no air conditioning, of course, would end up with soot on their clothes and the like. Instead, they had these nice, clean electric trains, much quieter, great acceleration, more reliable. And so there was something of what's called a sparks effect. You know, there were many more people deciding to travel on the line that had been electrified than using any alternative. But the trouble was that that lesson took ages to learn. And still, even today, we have major parts of the rail network which are still not electrified. And that probably represents a great failure, both for British Rail and its successors.
I'm wondering if we can sort of stay on this just for one more moment. That you mentioned British Rail sort of did this in the initial lines through subterfuge. And this was one of the more intriguing aspects of the book, or certainly perhaps one of the more unexpected ones. So I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit more about kind of how they did this and what it tells us about how British Rail was kind of constantly trying to manage being government run.
Yes, there's always something of a conflict there. And essentially, for most of the period of British Rail, the government would set a budget, often quite late in the process, you know, maybe January for the year starting in April the 1st or something, they'd learn of its budget. The government would probably earmark some of that money for particular schemes, like, you know, let's get some diesels bought, or let's electrify, you know, this particular line. But mostly, it was then up to British Rail to manage that budget and to try to limit any losses. And clearly, there's always tension in that process. British Rail is always trying to do things, wanting to invest in things, wanting to improve the network, wanting new rolling stock and the like. And the government is kind of sitting there often negating or saying no to certain schemes that British Rail wants to get through. So that is undoubtedly a relationship that is fraught, and more so because this idea that you can get a railway that pays for itself was never achieved. You know, it's always a kind of idea that, well, if you did this or this, and at one point they're saying if you cut certain things, and then in the modernization plan they were saying, well, if you invest in certain things, you get to this nirvana where the railway pays for itself and government no longer has to be involved. And that, it never happens. And it never happens because, to be honest, it's barely happens in any countries in the world. Railways have huge fixed assets, really heavy maintenance needs. And the idea that they can pay for themselves, or indeed that they should pay for themselves, is largely a impossible aim to achieve. And that is a kind of failure of the economics of transport, because any economist worth their salt would recognize that the externalities brought by the railways, in other words, the advantages to people who are not using them, such as in reduced congestion, reduced pollution, access to business, and so on, are not recognized in the fare box and should be therefore funded by society generally. And this is an argument that has raged almost since the onset of the railways.
One of the other arguments, or one of the other kind of sources of friction with British Rail that you talk about in the book, is obviously the really famous, or perhaps infamous, Beeching Report, which closes a massive number of stations, lines, and kind of, at least in myth, or maybe in the popular imagination, is kind of this horrible thing for British Rail. To what extent was the report entirely bad? Obviously, tell us a bit about the bad parts, but were there any sort of other aspects that were maybe important or accurate?
The Beeching Report has its genesis in the creation of the British Rail Board, where it's finally in the early 60s taken out of the British Transport Commission and given its own kind of independent structure. But there's a Tory government in power with a transport minister who's fairly hostile to the idea of railways, Ernest Marples. And he appoints Richard Beeching, who has no experience in the railways, he's actually an industrial chemist, works for ICI, as the chairman of this new British Rail Board, and asks for a report into the state of the railways, which is then published in 1963. Famously called Reshaping of Britain's Railways. And it essentially recommends vast swathes of closures. Now, there had been a closure program already. There were lots of lines that were built by the Victorians that duplicated other lines or went to small villages. Or you have to remember that the rail network in the 1890s, 1900s, was actually pretty much the only way of getting around for long distances. There were no effective roads, no cars. And so inevitably, there were lots of railways built to places that by the 1960s were well served by other transport means, whether it's buses or private cars or whatever. So it was inevitable that the network needed paring back. But Beeching's recommendation of effectively cutting more than a third of the network and more than half the stations arguably went too far. And certainly some of the lines that were closed as a result of his report should not have been closed. And of course, one could blame Beeching, but in fact, really, it was down to the politicians. And interestingly enough, there was an election in the middle of this in 1964. Labour took over with promises that it would reduce the number of cuts and did nothing of the sort. And actually, 1965 was the record year for cuts. So it was in a way, a rather it was an inevitable process, but one that was taken too far. And in it, Beeching did believe in the railways. He just believed in a pared down network that probably, if he'd really had his way, would have just linked certain major towns, say down to Exeter and Plymouth in the southwest, up to Edinburgh and Glasgow in the north, maybe not much north of that, maybe into Cardiff, but probably not much else in Wales, and so on. Kind of really paring back on the railways, which fortunately didn't happen, in the notion that this promise of having a rail network that was paid for itself could be established. Now, he had other ideas too. He improved the freight system. He created what are called merry-go-round trains, which were a way of transporting coal from mines through to the power stations, where they would drop from there through the rails very quickly without stopping. That's why they're called merry-go-round. Much more efficient than kind of having to load and unload wagons by hand and so on. So he did kind of improve things. He invented the intercity brand, which became the main way to link Britain's principal towns and so on. But he is remembered for the cuts he made and for the fact that he really was an axeman, and that's what he is known as in history.
Moving then to some of the heroes that you talk about in the book, one of them is Barbara Castle. Why is she one of the heroes of British Railways?
Well, transport ministers come in two sizes, really. They come in as roads people or as rail people, whether they favour one or the other. Most of them are roads people like Ernest Marples. Barbara Castle, who came in the second Labour government, 1966, as transport minister, was definitely somebody who favoured railways. She never had a driving licence, for example. And even though there were still some cuts that were made while she was transport secretary, she brought through an act which at last differentiated between the two railways, which are the commercial railway, where particularly intercity trains, some freight trains, even some suburban networks can pay for themselves and even make a profit, and therefore only need a light touch from a government. And then there's the social network, where lines to fairly seaside towns, branches that are maybe only used much in the summer, lines through like Wales, which are kind of relatively underpopulated and therefore never going to be profit making, and so on. And that is the social railway, and that's the railway that needs subsidizing. And this, why she's a hero or heroine in my book, is that she was the first to actually set that out and to say, well, this bunch of lines needs subsidizing, this bunch of lines can stand on its own. And that's a very important distinction, which is still, even today, not always properly understood by those running the railway, and certainly not by ministers who are hostile to the railways.
So one of the other kind of important figures, in addition, obviously, to transport secretaries, which, as you've just outlined, can be very key or very challenging, you also talk about in the book the chair people, the chairmen primarily of British Railways, also obviously having an important role to play. And I admit I was quite confused because literally two of them are named Robert Reed. But one of them goes by Bob Reed, which kind of helps. But Robert Reed, not Bob Reed, why do you consider him to have been the best chairman of British Rail?
Well, there was a series of ever-improving chairmen, and they were all men, of British Rail. And the first to really kind of try and grasp the nettle and understand the importance of having a public, a relationship with the public that presented the railways in a positive light was Sir Peter Parker, who was a brilliant fellow. I did actually get to meet him before he died. Was a fantastic kind of communicator, wrote a very funny business book about his life. Ensured he had good relationships with the politicians, with the unions, and with the public at large. And so he started the process really of making British Rail both more commercially minded, but also understanding its social obligations. And he ensured that his successor was Robert Reed, who was maybe a bit more hard-nosed than Peter Parker. But he reorganized the railways and managed to get rid of the old regional structure. And the regional structure, which was a hangover really from the days of the big four companies that ran British Rail between the 1920s and 1948, the regional structure really was something that stymied development. Each region kind of had its own boss, and they were called the kind of regional barons. They essentially made decisions which were mostly in their local interest, not necessarily in the interest of the organization as a whole. And over his near 10-year tenure as chairman, Robert Reed, the first of that name, changed the structure. So he devised a structure with five companies, essentially two freight companies, and then Intercity, which is a standalone, pretty much a standalone company, which ran the services between the main lines in the main cities in England, Wales, and Scotland. And then there was Provincial Railways, which became Regional Railways later on, which was the heavily loss-making lines, which needed a lot of social subsidy. And thirdly, Network South East, which was all the commuter lines in and out of London, stretching quite far, as much as 100 miles away, some of those services. And that was had been really neglected, even though it was a kind of mainstay of the British Rail's usage. Most passengers' journeys, 70 or 80%, started or ended in London. But that had been greatly neglected. And under particularly forward-looking leaders like Chris Green, as another hero in my book, who successfully ran ScotRail, Network South East, and later Intercity, Network South East was transformed and given an identity and improved enormously by in terms of the service it offered the commuters, who were, as I say, a very key part of British Rail's market.
So I wanted to ask about that, right? Because one of the things you do talk about, and I'm glad you mentioned Chris Green, had quite a big effect in two different parts of the country. But British Rail generally did work quite hard to attract people to use their trains. So I'm wondering if you can kind of tell us about how they tried to do this and what tended to work.
Well, one of the things that was really lost at privatisation was the whole branding of British Rail itself, but also the sub-brands of Intercity and Network South East in particular, and regional railways. And that was started also by Beeching, who commissioned the logo, the famous double arrow logo that, you know, very pleasingly is used on Google Maps to show a station. Beeching, under Beeching and his successors, they developed a very strong branding exercise, you know, thinking through the colour schemes, thinking through how the station names were displayed, thinking through the whole typography of the rail network, the colour schemes for both inside and outside the rolling stock, and so on. And that gave British Rail a strong identity. Built upon that, they created the sub-brands, like Intercity in particular, with some amazing advertising, which was very popular, TV advertising. And it became a widely known brand. You didn't take the train, you took Intercity. And actually, oddly enough, it's a brand that has been used by in other countries across the world, actually, just imitating Intercity. That was a particularly successful part of British Rail, so much so that the whole corporate identity idea was then imitated by many private companies. But it was actually down to British Rail, who developed, you know, produced a huge manual with loose leaves in it, so you could change the particular aspects of it, highlighting all the different aspects of this branding. And you know, the fact that, you know, the twin arrow logo survives today and is going to be used by Great British Railways, the company that the government is going to set up to essentially be the guiding mind of the railways, is a testimony to the talent of railway managers, which is something worth emphasizing, actually, that, you know, far from being a kind of dismal set of people who, you know, were not interested in the commercial aspects of the railway and didn't really have much idea of what they were doing and didn't care and were sloppy, there was a cohort of managers who went through a training scheme, a graduate training scheme, joined at the age of 21, 22, and were highly successful, indeed so successful that for the first 20 years of privatization, it was they who ran most of the train companies that took over from British Rail.
I'd love to ask about another sort of successful part of British Railways. In fact, you call it in the book the pinnacle. What was organising for quality and why was it such a success?
Well, first of all, Robert Reed had to break up the regional barons and create these three passenger companies and two freight companies. Just in the last couple of years of British Rail's life, he then gave quite a lot of freedom to these organizations, which became really semi-freestanding organizations run by managers who, yes, they were given a budget by Central British Rail and told to try to keep within it, but were able to make all sorts of decisions around investment, around ticket pricing, around all sorts of aspects of operating the railway, timetabling in particular, that meant they could essentially control their product. So there were businesses in themselves with, as the very notion organizing for quality kind of suggests, with the notion that they were very much public facing, that as much as possible within you know, bounds of possibility, they were commercial, and they were always looking at increasing the numbers on the railway, which you know, they managed largely to do. Since the mid-80s, actually, numbers did start to go up, except in the late 80s, early 90s, when there was a recession, which always reduced numbers using the railways, because so much of the market was around commuting. But for by and large, the last 10, 15 years of British Rail was very successful in terms of its commercial aspects.
Why then was British Rail privatized?
Yes, why indeed? The excuses given were, and I did manage to eventually get a kind of, when I worked on a TV program, get a letter from John Major, who was Prime Minister at the time, as to why he did it. And he set it out in a letter. And in that letter, he says, well, British Rail was inefficient. It was unimaginative. It didn't have good managers, and so on. None of which was actually true. It was really privatized for ideological reasons. It was privatized because they'd sold off everything that they could sell off: water, electricity, the trustees' savings bank, gas, and so on. And there was nothing left to privatize after Tory rule from 1979 to 92. Surprisingly, the Conservatives won the 92 election with a manifesto promise of privatising British Rail. Nobody really quite knew how they were going to do it. They certainly didn't. But they were then committed to it created a very complicated model involving franchising, involving separating, most importantly, involving separating out the infrastructure, which is the stations and the track and the like, from the operations, and privatise them in different ways. And that was the absolute crucial aspect, with the idea that you could have competition. But, you know, as they soon found out, having competition in a rail network is very difficult because, you know, there's only one set of tracks up to anywhere, and making that competitive is very difficult. It's very difficult for trains to pass each other and so on. But so essentially, to answer your question, there is no doubt that the abiding reason for the sell-off was ideological and not kind of one that was born of any particular interest in improving the lot for passengers. There was a claim that this would reduce subsidy, but rather amusingly, subsidy kind of increased massively because of the structure that was created. It was very complex and involved lots of contracts and a lot of kind of complicated ways of operating, a lot of compensation paid to particular parties when things went wrong and so on. And, you know, to this day, the railway system is much more heavily subsidized than it ever was under British Rail.
That's rather a long list of problems with privatization, and certainly kind of makes clear why this was, as you said, there wasn't even really a plan when it was announced, and the plan didn't necessarily think through kind of how rail doesn't necessarily operate like other industries do. How then, kind of take us up to the present day, how does the government now think about railways in Britain?
Okay, well, there is a fundamental problem with the railways. Well, there's several, but there is one fundamental problem, that it loses money. And therefore, you can't just sell it off and say, right, you know, like Coca-Cola or whatever, you know, you go off and run it, because there is always the need to subsidize services and, by and large, subsidize most of the investment in the railways. So that is one of the problems why, you know, this complex structure is always going to struggle. And the other aspect of it is that the railways are not like aviation, and this comparison is often made. And people say, well, the aviation industry kind of thrives on the fact that, you know, the airport is owned by one company, the planes are probably leased from another company, and then they're operated by a third company. Nobody much worries about any of that. Well, the railways are not like that. I mean, the railways are always on the pair of tracks. The trains are always on the pair of tracks. They always need to be signaled by people in the signaling centres. It's very difficult, as I suggested, to run different trains between the two same parts, it's twin cities, a pair of cities. So they're always going to be problematic in terms of creating conventional capitalism. And I think that has always been the problem, has been the idea that, we can just kind of run the railways as a conventional business. And I've always called that faux capitalism, because they need regulation, they need control, they need government funds, they need government decision over what services you want to run, and so on. So there is always this uneasy relationship. So this franchising idea has survived just about to this day, but was destroyed by COVID. So what happened was that the franchises were, about 25 franchises were sold off, and that means, it's a slightly strange word, because franchises, you envisioned McDonald's, but essentially companies were given 5, 7, or in one case, 20-year deals under which they would operate the services, they would collect the fares, and they would either, depending on what sort of lines they took over, get subsidy to help them pay for it, or pay a premium if it was particularly into city lines, which were likely to be profitable, and therefore they would be able to pay money towards the cost of running them. They would pay access to the infrastructure, they would pay charges for that, for every mile they ran their trains, and that would go to what was initially another privatized company, Railtrack. But that soon collapsed within 4 or 5 years of privatisation, particularly as a result of some accidents and some investment decisions, and was soon nationalised as Network Rail. So that part of privatisation was a failure. The rolling stock was sold off to three different companies, and they also bought a lot of new rolling stock, which they then leased to the train companies, which in turn then got the money for the leases essentially from the government. So that was a privatization, but it's subsidized by government. And then the third aspect to it was the franchises, which collapsed when COVID happened, because railway usage went down to 5%, down to 5%, not down by 5%, down to 5% of previous use. Clearly, the idea that the franchises could take the revenue risk, in other words, pocket the fares, was no longer viable, and therefore the franchise system collapsed. And it was already in the process of being changed. And now the idea is that there will be a guiding mind, a new company called Great British Railways, that will make investment decisions, that will operate the trains, although probably passing under contracts to private companies, but in a very limited way. They'll have management contracts, which means that the fare box will all go to Great British Railways, and these private companies will run the services, like often bus services are run, you know, to a schedule and at prices that are set by Great British Railways. But this has not been yet decided, and so the railways are at the moment in a state of flux, and the Great British Railways will require legislation. And given that the state of the British government at the moment, where we are awaiting a new prime minister and the like, it's unlikely that we'll get much clarity over the future of the railways for 6 months or a year.
So clearly, then, the government, whoever it ends up being, has rather a lot of work to do next. What, may I ask, as we come to the end of this, now that your book on British Rail is done, what are you working on now or next?
I've suggested in the book, and lots of people within the industry agree with me, that you either need a fully privatized network, which I think is impossible because of the reasons I've stated about requiring subsidy and it being an essential service and etc., or you have a fully nationalized network, and basically you recreate a version of British Rail. You can't quite recreate it because the rolling stock has been sold off. Lots of very useful parts of it, like the research department and the catering aspects, have all been sold off. But you could have a strong organization which ran the trains, that was responsible for infrastructure, that was in charge of long-term strategy, that made investment decisions, made decisions over fares, and so on, which was the case with British Rail, and was by and large, as you know, in its final days, a pretty successful model. But that is not what we're going to get, and I will continue arguing that it is the best thing, that the best result of this process. But it remains to be seen exactly what this new structure will be. I suspect, particularly if we get a Labour government, that it will try and simplify the structure that is being built up, because oddly enough, one of the motivations behind this new structure was to simplify the system. But they've got about 200 consultants working on it at the moment, and it looks as if they're going to create a model that is just as complicated as the current one.
It doesn't sound simple, I have to admit. So I'm glad that an expert like you also thinks it's perhaps more complicated than it needs to be. So then, before I let you go, you have written, as you said, quite a number of books on the topic, and clearly remain very invested in the future of railways in the UK. Might you be able to share with us in a sentence or two, a teaser, I suppose, of what you might be working on next as your next project?
Well, I'm afraid I'm working on something totally different. I wrote a book called Engines of War about 10 years ago. And in it, I postulated that the role of the railways in warfare had not been understood. And in fact, the railways were largely responsible for the great upscaling in wars. Compare the Napoleonic War, where the Battle of Waterloo was over in a day, with 100 years later, the Battle of the Somme, which took most of a whole year. And the railways played a big role in that, in supplying both sides in kind of enabling them to be entrenched and so on. And indeed, the railways are playing a big part in the war in Ukraine at the moment. And one of the things that was done early on was part of the network was destroyed by the Ukrainians to stop the Russians using the rail network. So my new book is, I'm very tempted to write a book on that, but I'm commissioned at the moment to write a book on the role of the railways in the liberation of France in 1944. So the network was virtually totally destroyed by a combination of Allied bombing and, in particular, sabotage by the Resistance, helped by a lot of explosive delivered by the RAF. And so when the invasion started on June the 6th, 1944, a lot of railway troops were sent over to rebuild the railways. And that story has never been told. We often hear about the logistics that, you know, oh, it was all done by trucks. In fact, 2/3 of the material that was carried by rail. Lots of railway were rebuilt by troops, often even under fire in very difficult conditions. Bridges were rebuilt amazingly rapidly, right into Germany, actually, to enable the lines of communication to continue. And so my story, which will be published early in 2024, called The Liberation Line, will explain that process, will tell this story for really for the first time ever. Nobody has really kind of written about it in any detail. And it is an absolutely fantastic story.
That sounds absolutely fascinating, definitely. Well, best of luck with that project. And hopefully when it does come out, maybe we can entice you back to tell us about it then. Amazing. Well, while you are off writing that, listeners can read the book we've been discussing, again, titled British Rail, A New History from Penguin in 2022. Christian Walmart, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
A great pleasure. Thank you.